Dag, ik ben Michiel de Hoog en ik ben correspondent sport bij De Correspondent. Recent kreeg ik het aanbod om Malcolm Gladwell te interviewen. Malcolm Gladwell, sterjournalist en inspiratie voor schrijvers bij De Correspondent en ik denk eerlijk gezegd ook voor veel lezers van De Correspondent. Mijn voorbereidingstijd was kort, maar uiteindelijk koos ik ervoor om het toch maar te gaan doen en het was een leuk gesprek. Mijn stuk over het interview kun je nu lezen op de site, maar je kunt ook luisteren naar mijn gesprek met Gladwell in het Engels. Even nog wat opmerkingen erbij. Er komen een aantal namen in ons gesprek voorbij, zoals van Harry Markopoulos. Markopoulos is een financieel analist die al vrij vroeg de fraude van de investeerder Bernie Madoff in de gaten had. Ook verwijst Gladwell een keer naar Karim. En Karim is een interviewer van de School of Life, het instituut dat Gladwell uitgenodigd had naar Nederland. Ik hoop dat je het een leuk gesprek vindt en ik ben benieuwd wat je ervan vond. Laat het me weten.
So, I'm sitting in the Dillon Hotel with Malcolm Gladwell. Writer of several best-selling non-fiction books, such as The Tipping Point, Blink, Outliers. He's the producer and host of the podcast Revisionist History, facilitator of other people's podcasts as the founder of Pushkin Industries, a skinny Canadian, and a runner, I was about to say, but sadly...
Injured at the moment.
Yeah. All right. So did I miss anything in this short introduction?
No, you've covered it all. Yeah.
And I was actually about to ask, what kind of are you? So I'm sorry if you don't mind talking about the running.
We get them. Oh no, I'm delighted to.
Are you a front foot runner or?
I'm a four foot runner. I was a middle distance runner as a young man, but now I run 5Ks and miles and things like that. I am definitively not a marathoner. So that's a big distinction in my mind between, I'm not as crazy as the marathoners.
Right. And so four-foot running, was that you adapting to the sort of newish trend to it? Or
pretty natural for me. I mean, I know as a kid I was not, but when I began running again seriously as an adult, I don't even know how to run on my heels anymore. So it's just how I kind of naturally.
All right. So I just wonder about this. Hey, you're not here to run, obviously, but you talk about your new book, Talking to Strangers, which is, as the Amazon page would have it, a powerful examination of our interactions with strangers and why they often go wrong. And I would say also why we as humans are mostly correct in assuming that others are honest. Mm-hmm. But sometimes we are very wrong. I'm interested more generally in how you pick your topics. And yesterday in the Tivoli Vredenburg, you told a fun story about the genesis of talking to strangers and your general theory of the interestingness of memoirs.
Yes. Yeah.
So can you share this story with us, the listeners, because most of us will not have been there.
You know, memoirs are an extraordinarily fruitful way of hunting for ideas. But not all memoirs are useful. So I've developed a kind of theory, armchair theory, as to which ones are most useful. And it's, if you imagine a grid where one axis is interesting on one end and boring on the other, and the other axis is constrained on one end and unconstrained on the other. And so, you know, the memoir of the Prime Minister of the Netherlands would be interesting, but constrained, right? Because his life is extraordinarily interesting, but very few of the interesting things he can relate in a memoir because they're secret or he has ongoing relationships. On the other hand, an ordinary citizen can write a memoir that is unconstrained. They can tell you everything they want, but probably boring because they're just living an ordinary life. So what you want is the memoir in the middle that is interesting enough that you want to read it, but the person's not so famous that they are constrained. And I decided the sweet spot was memoirs of retired government civil servants, in particular those who had served in the intelligence services. And so I just began to read lots of them, and they're marvelous. Two of the stories in the book come from reading these largely unread memoirs of kind of relatively obscure intelligence officers.
So did you go read these memoirs of these civil servants, former civil servants, retired civil servants, with a specific goal in mind?
Things. So I have with me on this trip, I have four or five books, six books, some of which are books I think will be useful. But I have with me a memoir of a relatively obscure, not a government civil service, but a Jesuit priest, which I don't know, I think there might be something interesting in it. I'm always reading things just on the off chance that I'll stumble across something fascinating in it.
Right. So the name of the specific civil servant, I think it was a former CIA officer, who he told the story of the mountaineer, right?
Yes, he's told this absolutely fascinating. It was a CIA desk officer who ran the Latin America desk for the CIA for many years, who told this fascinating story about that appears in the book about two spies, a CIA operative named the Mountain Climber, and a Cuban spy called Florentino Espiaga. And that is one of the first stories I tell in the book because it strikes at the heart of many of the themes I'm interested in particular why human beings are so easily deceived.
So I'd like to talk a bit about your work process in general, the hunting for ideas. So is the memoir actually a bedrock of this process, or are there other sources?
No, I go through. There are obviously many sources of ideas. Sometimes I just kind of spend the day in libraries or online looking at anything that kind of strikes my fancy. A good example of the way I work actually happened yesterday. 2 days ago, I don't remember why. I was reading about museums because I was interested in a Van Gogh that was in the collection of a museum in Detroit. And the museum wanted to sell the Van Gogh and the community objected, even though the Van Gogh was probably fake. And I thought that was such a curious notion that people would have had an affection and an attachment to a work of art, even though the work of art may well be fake. But it struck me as one of many curiosities about the art market. The art market is a kind of crazy market. So I was just thinking about this, about how would I turn this into an episode of my podcast? Because I thought it would be kind of intriguing. And yesterday, when I was having a drink after the talk in Utrecht with the guy who interviewed me, Karim, a philosopher, I told him this. And then I got really interested in the fact that the vast majority of the collection of any museum is in storage. Right, 95% of typically. And so I was talking about it with him, and he said, well, you know, this is like the, and he said, well, it's like the mythological dragon. Dragons in mythology are hoarders. The dragon sits on a pile of gold. So he was suggesting that the museum is rather like the mythological dragon. And the point of the prince comes along and tries to slay the dragon. Hmm. But the dragon has no interest in the things that he hoards. Right, he also hoards virgins. He's no interest in the virgin. He's no interest in spending the gold. He just wants to sit on them, right? So this is like a fantastic idea. So I came back last night after Utrecht and I was looking up and I had forgotten that in The Hobbit by Tolkien, it is the story of Bilbo Baggins trying to slay the dragon, Smaug, who is, remember, Baggins goes and steals the golden chalice and the dragon from the dragon, and the dragon misses the chalice, even though he's got a mound of gold. So it's exactly the same story as the Detroit Museum, which is sitting on a mound of art, and someone wants to take one little tiny chalice, which is, by the way, not even a gold chalice, a fake one. And what does the dragon do? The dragon gets so angry that, remember, the dragon comes after Bilbo Baggins in the Hobbit. Anyway, that... You know, I can say with a high degree of certainty, some version of that story will appear in an episode of my podcast, Revisionist History.
Season number
five.
Five.
But that's a very good idea. So it was a combination of, I randomly read something online, and then I like to tell people what I'm working on, because you never know what someone will add to the story. And it would never have occurred to me to kind of make the connection to mythology. But of course, I was thinking of making the connection to clinical hoarding. you know, the kind of person who collects objects in there. But that's not very interesting. The dragon is really interesting. And also the dragon's funny. A person hoarding is actually not funny, it's sad. Mm-hmm. But to compare museums to dragons sitting on piles of gold is hilarious. So
the original story of the Van Gogh in the museum,
yeah,
that is a random thing.
Yeah, that I got interested in that. Why was I interested in that? I can't remember why. Oh, I know why. And I read something, some random thing about the curious fact that museums do not put their art on their balance sheet, which is, it may turn out to be a fact I don't even talk about, but it's this fascinating fact. So I'm a museum and I have, you know, one of the museums on the museum plane here might have billions of dollars of art, easily. I don't know if, but in America, I don't know if this is true here. In America, if you look at the annual, the financial statement of the museum, they will list as all their assets, the building, the real estate, the whatever. They don't list the art as an asset, which is crazy. So when the museum comes to the state in America and says, we're running out of money, as they always do, they always say, well, look, we have expenses of this and assets of this. We're in the red. But they don't count the thing.
Why is that?
Well, I don't know. I've ordered, there's a book written on this that I've ordered that I'll read when I get back to America.
Oh, right. I don't know the case. So, and the art market in general, you feel, is a...
I find it funny. I think the whole thing is hilarious. And I'm not quite sure why I find it funny, but this summer I was reading books on the art market for this very reason. And then I just read a famous biography of one of the great art dealers of the early Joseph Duveen. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know much about him, and I was reading him. So I've been sort of mildly curious about the art market for a while.
Hey, and there is a point where you feel, I guess, that a certain topic is ripe for an article, a pod, or maybe a book. But of course, you cannot do them all. So is there some kind of a filter mechanism or thing that you use? So what do you do and what do you don't do?
Well, I generally have so few ideas. Ideas are very scarce. So there are very few ideas that if an idea reaches the point where it's interesting to me, I almost certainly do something with it. Some writers have a whole file full of unused ideas. I do not. I mean, I have a handful of ideas but I've never used them only because they're just not good enough. I'm hoping one day I don't have a kind of archive of things to dip into. I start afresh every year. When I started thinking about season 5 of my podcast, I had 0 ideas. So I'm now up to 6. I need 4 more.
So there are not, because that was a question I was about to ask, any unwritten Gladwells or stuff left
there? To me, the generation of ideas is always the hardest part. And so nothing ever goes to waste.
Right. And so once you decide to go for something, it's good enough and you will pursue it until the end.
Yeah, there's some things that take a couple of go-rounds. So 2 years ago, I did all this reporting about this crazy story involving the city of Houston and how they fired all their teachers. And I did a bunch of interviews, which I have. I don't quite know what to do with them because I haven't. These are all for podcast interviews, so podcast episodes. And a podcast episode, to work, it needs to have a kind of, at least for my purposes, for revisionist history, there are always stories that they need to have a point. They have to reflect on something larger. And I don't know what that story reflects on. I have some ideas. You have to have if you have 10 episodes in a season, they have to have variety. And so if too many of the stories have the same feel, then I have to put one aside and find another one.
So is this a story that, like, you know it's good, but it's not quite there yet? So it's a thing that has eluded you, so to speak? Is there something that you've been looking for a long time but haven't managed to do properly?
One idea, I remember I famously put aside for 10 years and then came back to it. I finally figured out what the missing element was.
What was that?
It was about a scientist who helped to invent the birth control pill, who was a Catholic.
John Rock.
I heard about him many, many years ago. But, well, even before that, this doctor friend of mine had told me about this sort of curious argument about how Menstruation for a modern woman is an unnatural state. Historically, women did not menstruate every month. For the overwhelming majority of human history, women rarely menstruated because they were either continuously pregnant or continuously breastfeeding from the moment of puberty through menopause. And so the number of lifetime menses for a woman up until the 20th century or late 19th century was, it might be a dozen. Now, of course, it could easily be, you know, in the hundreds. And there's a whole literature on, there's a whole kind of literature on what's called excessive menstruation. Very obscure. And someone told me about this when I was in my 20s. Someone told me about this. And I thought about it for 10 years before I could figure out how to write about it. I just thought it was fascinating.
Right. Do people ever offer their stories to you? So like, hey, Mr. Gladwell, I'm very interesting to write about. Here's my fantastic story.
Yeah, those rarely work. What works is what I described with Kareem yesterday, where I present a fragment of a story to someone and they add to it. That works a lot.
Maybe a bit of a diversion from the writing process. So before you joined the New Yorker as a writer, you worked for the Washington Post. Were you able to, and to what extent, to write in the same fashion that you've now become famous for and that you've done in the New Yorker? Because a newspaper generally has a more dryish kind of style.
Yeah. Not really. I mean, because you can't write at length. Mm-hmm. Everything's very short. So the room, there were little bits of it, but I really couldn't do the kind of writing. I used to do freelance writing on the side when I worked at the Washington Post, which was much more similar to the kind of writing I would later do in my books. Mm-hmm. The newspaper reporting would supply a lot of the raw material for things I wanted to write about, mm-hmm. but not, it wasn't really a good home for the kind of style that I wanted to write in.
Yeah, and now I think you've mentioned before in interviews that you did not invent the style or the genre.
I never thought of it. Mm-hmm. I don't even think of it as being a genre. I'm almost so slightly mystified by that term. I mean, I think of myself as just, there are endless varieties of nonfiction writing.
Yeah,
and mine is one of them.
Yeah, and it was there before you did it, obviously. So what and who inspired you in this sense?
Many writers. I've always read a lot of Janet Malcolm. I've always read a lot of Michael Lewis. I've always read a lot of... specifically, there were some psychologists. There was a brilliant book called The Person in the Situation written by a psychologist called Richard Nisbet and Lee Ross, which I read very early on, which is a kind of academic's version of the kind of writing I did. But it is a combination of theory and story. And it was very influential in the way I write. I think of that really as being, if I had to point to a book that directly inspired me, it was that.
Yeah.
I mean, it blew my mind.
Yeah.
It was a kind of, they are people who believe that human behavior and motivation and belief can only be understood in the context of their environment and situation. And I've remained very firmly in that camp ever since. That's me. I mean, that's what I believe. They're dubious about the meaning of personality as a standalone thing. And I am as well. I don't think you can abstract someone's personality from their situation.
And that framed your way of looking at things and
to this day. I mean, in talking to strangers, almost every one of my books has a chapter, which is really a kind of Nisbetian argument about the importance of understanding environment and situation.
So at the end of the year, our writers, we write and try and think of our so-called standpunten, which is stood points, translate roughly. So a standpoint you used to have, but not anymore. You've changed your mind because of new emerging, mm-hmm. Or you yourself finding new information. I think the journalist David Epstein, I think you talked to him recently and he noticed, he said, I'm quoting here, that you are excellent at updating your mental models.
Yeah. So, David is a very good friend of mine.
Yeah.
My general position is that if there's a conflict between what I believe and what David believes, you should believe David. So I take that very seriously. So whenever I find myself disagreeing with him, I usually try and move closer to his position. He's much more intelligent than I am, and he's a better runner. So there's on every front, he's a superb. He's had a big influence on my thinking. He would say that, and I think he's being overly generous, that the idea for the book Range came out of a conversation we had years ago. We were debating on stage, although we weren't really debating. But Range may be really, in Outliers, I was very interested in this question of how much preparation expertise requires. I was thinking of preparation in a very narrow way. And what Range made me realize was that when we talk about preparation for something, it can include a extraordinary range of things. So you do need a long period of preparation to be, for example, a great tennis player. But that long period doesn't necessarily just involve tennis. So Federer being the great example. Federer was well served by his experience outside of tennis, just as Nobel Prize winners are in, physics are well served by their experience in music, or, that idea that true expertise requires this kind of very broad base was a kind of real eye-opening thing in Range. It made me realize that that was a bit that was missing from my book Outliers. Similarly, the sports gene was, this sports gene sort of greatly complicated in a really good way my thinking about athletic performance. Mm-hmm. What I hadn't realized was the extent to which athletic greatness is by definition almost deviant. It's not, they're not normal, right? It's because they're not normal that they're great. They're not, in other words, the great soccer player is not just a good soccer player optimized. The great soccer player is almost a different species. That was a really interesting insight that I thought a lot about.
So you would say so those were two stood points, so to speak.
I have lots of them, though. I mean, if you read all of my books in a row, you see that in four of my five books, I've written about law enforcement, and there's a vast difference between the way I write about it in my first book and the way I write about it in Talking to Strangers. I mean, I've really both deepened and fundamentally altered my perspective on what effective law enforcement looks like.
Can you tell me a little bit more about this?
Well, my first book was very, tipping point, was very interested in the kind of immediate positive effects of aggressive policing. By the time we get to Talking to Strangers, I'm most concerned about the side effects of positive policing, the downside of it. I've gone 180. I've gone from being kind of in love with what you can positively do if police intervene in a meaningful way in the environment. And now I'm much more concerned about what can go wrong when they do that. And that the notion that the side effects may be so significant that it makes the intervention not worth it. That's an idea I would not have had 20 years ago.
Right. Has that developed only in the researching of the Talking to Strangers? Or
no, it was also, there's a piece of that argument in David and Goliath as well. There's the beginning of that shift in Blink. In the last, because remember, Blink ends with a story about a police shooting. And it's about, that on a kind of cautionary tale about how police need to kind of moderate their aggressiveness. So I sort of feel like it begins there, and then it's just kind of, I've continued going down that path of moving away from my original enthusiasm for proactive policing.
Right. And coming back to the early specialization versus late specialization, I think, which you hinted at in with Range and the diversity of athletic skills being needed to achieve greatness later on, that has evolved too, I think, right? It hasn't simply come from reading Range and then thinking, oh God, he's probably right.
Well, it crystallized. What David does is he takes ideas that you may have had in parts or in pieces, and he puts them, he both crystallizes them and he gives you an extraordinary amount of research behind them. So he makes you realize what we know and what we don't know. So that's what David, when I read David's books, they kind of organize my scattered thoughts. Tell me where I should put my emphasis and where I should continue to be skeptical. Which I think is what good writing always does.
Yeah. A bit of a similar theme is you changing your mind, we talked about now, but you also have the, I would assume, the ambition to change other people's minds, right? Mm-hmm. So recently in this talk with, I think, Michael Lewis, he remarked on your remarkable ability to, and I quote again here, to make him believe the most unbelievable bullshit, right? I thought it was very interesting. But recently, when you talked to Oprah Winfrey, you mentioned that you may not be able to change other people's minds as much anymore as you used to, maybe.
I've never thought I could change people's minds. This is, other people have said that I possess this mysterious power. I've never said that. In fact, I said once in the introduction or the afterword to one of my books that my goal was not to change minds. It was to engage people. And I still think that's the case. I don't think a writer should have as an ambition or can have. They should. They can try. But reasonably, you cannot expect your book to change people's minds. I mean, it might happen, but I don't think that can be a reasonable expectation. What you hope to do is simply to make people think and to re-examine their position. Where they'll end up is up to them. I can't point you in a direction, but I can make you think. You know, talking to strangers is intended to just to make you re-examine your communication strategies. But, you know, do I think it'll help, it'll force people to stop doing job interviews? No, it's not going to stop them doing job interviews. I mean, that's asking too much. But maybe it will cause them to kind of reflect a bit more on their dealings with strangers, and that's useful.
Right. Yeah, because sometimes your articles can read as, so like, you make the case for a certain standpoint or a certain way of viewing things, which makes for compelling reading. But I was just wondering whether the actual goal was to change people's minds.
I don't think so. I mean, in the podcast, it's become clearer. The job of engaging has become clearer. So, you know, when I say that Pat Boone belongs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I don't assume that he's going to get voted in next year. It's never going to happen. But it's very useful to think about why he does belong there. You know, that's all.
Correct. I read this old interview with you from 2000 from the New York Times. And the interviewer, he marveled at this thing you had. And it was, you had your own website. And apparently at the time that was something presumptuous or something. It was clear to me. So you had two replies to this. One, it's a pain, and I quote again, to fax people your articles all the time, which is the main reason why I have a website. A fax. And the second reply is, you'd be surprised at what you learn. An incredible number of my ideas have come from incredibly random conversations I have. So how does this work nowadays? Now, the internet is still obviously in its infancy or even before, but still the interaction you get now probably from online sources is much greater than before.
Yeah, although it's funny. The best interactions are always face-to-face. They're not on, I mean, the most fruitful ones. You do get some things, you know, little pieces sometimes come in emails or what have you, but the better ones are always, the best ideas are always the ones that come serendipitously. The problem with the internet is that the one thing the internet's bad at is serendipity. You still can't reproduce. I used to sometimes just walk down the aisles of libraries and just look at books. It just kind of, or go into the publications room and just randomly pick up academic journals and look at them. That is much easier to do in person than it is to do, the online equivalent of that doesn't really exist. All searches are directed. And directed search is never going to be as fruitful for new ideas as serendipitous search. And conversations are serendipitous search. You don't know what someone's going to say. So that's why they're so much more useful. So I think I was probably in the early days of the internet more optimistic about its long-term usefulness than I am now. It's merely an efficiency if you know what you want.
So now you're short on the internet.
I'm increasingly, is my life better? Would my life be better if the internet had never been invented? Absolutely, in every way. We'd be so much happier. Think about a world with no emails. It just would be amazing.
I think you mentioned yesterday also when you're talking Tivoli how you recommend the Twitter breaks and I think Facebook breaks. And
I don't go on Facebook at all, or I don't even know what my Facebook account is. I don't go on Instagram, Twitter. I only follow, I think, 60 people, most of whom are runners who never tweet. So I have very limited Twitter kind of load. Mm-hmm. I don't understand people who follow thousands of people. It just seems to me like, I mean, it's what an extraordinary burden you've created for yourself.
And Facebook and Instagram, why not them?
I don't understand what the value of Facebook is. I mean, I don't get my news from there. I know how to get news. So I guess people use it to keep track of their family, but my family doesn't do Facebook. So I don't know why I would go on it. I literally have never gone on Facebook. I've never understood it. In the early days, I mean, it was different. In the early days, I was on some message boards in the 90s. And they actually were really great. There was one in New York called Echo. And I used to go on Echo in the 90s. And Echo was just a bunch of nerds who had fantastic, you know, would tell you fantastic stuff. So that was useful back then.
Right. So now, but there's also this other part of the online culture. So every time, I think, particularly when you write stuff, there is within a couple of hours like a storm of criticism. It's like a subgenre. Mm. Clever people ganging up to find holes in whatever you've written, right? Mm. And then they turn in like these hot take articles on serious websites. Does this ever help? Does this ever generate? Because there are, maybe not well intentioned, maybe, but there are a lot of clever people looking for inconsistencies or wrong, and they.
Yeah.
Sometimes nasty in the way they describe it, obviously, and maybe not well-intentioned, but there could be something useful in this, I wondered.
Yeah, sometimes you learn things. I mean, I tend not to read a lot of that kind of response. So, I mean, the better stuff, the well-intentioned stuff is sort of easy to find. And that is very useful because people will also tell you about interesting critiques. But the other stuff, I just sort of, I don't know, I just kind of ignore it. I think it's kind of just goes with the territory. And if you have lots of readers, you have lots of critics. I mean, it's just a straight linear. So if I sell, just as a hypothetical, if 80% of the people who read something of mine like it, that strikes me as being a very high, fantastic number, right? I would be happy if you told me I had 80% approval rating among my readers. So if 1 million people buy Talking to Strangers, which is not impossible, we're almost there. That's 200,000 critics, right? So if I read it, when I see lots of critics, I just think, oh, that must mean I have lots of readers. Mm-hmm. And it's win-win.
Yes, but I would also assume actually in the feedback, it would be hard to sift through the quality of the feedback. But if there is a lot, there could be a lot of actually brilliant people telling you, hey, maybe it's the other way around.
Yeah, usually the other thing is I've moved on half the time, so not terribly interested in someone's critique of Outliers at this point. Or
no.
I'm not going back there. I'm trying to do my next thing. So I feel like as a writer, you have a limited amount of time. And I choose to spend my time not in reading responses to things I've written, but rather in trying to read things that I don't know about. Maybe it's unusual. I'm just indifferent to these kinds of criticism.
It's very useful, I guess.
I just like don't understand the point of
how do you seek out criticism before you publicize it?
I do that. Then it's useful. Yeah. So then I circulate things, and I'm someone who talks a lot about what I'm working on. Mm-hmm. I test out ideas well in advance of even writing them down. I was telling the group last night about this. Just this idea I've been playing with for 24 hours, trying to see what part of it people were interested in. So it's both, I'm testing the idea to see if there's interest, and I'm also showcasing the idea to see who can add to it. So that I do a lot. I think it's a hugely important part of the process. I almost always do a kind of run-through of tell some, at least, you know, a handful of people will just talk through the idea and just see if it's as exciting to them as it is to me.
And once you finish the article or podcast, is there a, you send it once more? Is there like a system maybe? Or
we have a system, an elaborate system at Pushkin. So beginning with what happened is I'll write a script, we'll do a table read, and I'll invite a random, my editors, but also producer, but also anyone who's interested can come. And then afterwards we tear it apart for an hour or more. And I often will go back and completely rewrite it. And then I might rewrite it 3 or 4 different times, sometimes even more. So with the podcast in particular, there is a very rigorous, and with the book, you know, probably 10 or 15 people read it very carefully, well before publication.
Okay. So one of the central themes in Talking to Strangers is a concept which has been coined, I think, by the psychologist Tim Levine, default to truth. Mm-hmm. Could you, for the people who haven't read the book yet, describe what that entails?
Yeah, default to truth is just, Levine is one of many researchers who is puzzled about why we're bad at, why are human beings so bad at detecting deception? Because we are bad at it. And it doesn't seem to make sense. Levine argues that the reason we're bad at it is that evolution has paradoxically selected us to be bad at it. That it's much more advantageous to be trusting than it is to be suspicious. Trusting people are much more lovable, are much easier to cooperate with, have stronger ties to community, are capable of creating almost anything of value that a human being does is enhanced by being trusting. The same cannot be said of being suspicious. If we have been selected to be trusting, it just means that we have this Achilles heel that on those occasions when someone sets out to deceive us, they're likely to succeed. But it's a small price to pay for being good at almost everything else that's of value as a human being. And he calls that default to truth.
Yes. Have you? So it's in all of us to a large extent, I suppose, except for the Harry Merck Coppolas of the world. Did you ever default to truth in your work when maybe you should not have?
Oh, yeah.
Have you been tricked by someone, in other words?
Tricked is too strong a word, but I have fallen for... I remember once years ago, I wrote an article about a woman named Susan Love. Susan Love was... a researcher who was very concerned about the effects of estrogen replacement therapy on women's health. And at the time, the scientific consensus was that it was not merely harmless, but of enormous value for menopausal women to take estrogen replacement therapy. Susan Love was not convinced, and she was a lone voice in the wilderness. And I wrote an article in which I was extraordinarily dismissive of her ideas, because I was like, look, science has decided that it's a good idea. Who is this woman to say, I don't believe so? And then, lo and behold, of course, science changed its mind and Susan Love turned out to be correct. I defaulted to truth on estrogen replacement therapy. I was insufficiently skeptical of the scientific consensus. And there's a situation where, as a journalist, one should respect the scientific consensus, but built into the notion of science is the idea that science is more than willing to change its mind if the evidence shifts. Mm-hmm. So consensus is not the same thing as truth, right? Mm-hmm. And I fell into the mistake of thinking consensus was truth. I was, you know, much younger and more naive, and I have tried to learn from that you must always be deeply respectful of those who challenge scientific consensus, even though they are often wrong, because who knows which way science will go? You know, you have to kind of always leave open the possibility that the winds will shift. So that was a very valuable lesson, that in my role as journalist, I need to moderate kind of default to the status quo.
Yeah. It's a hard lesson, though, I would assume. If I think about what you can learn from this one particular case.
Yeah, very hard. And it means, you know, cases where, you know, you desperately want, when you write about climate change, I'm a, you know, 100% believer in the scientific consensus on climate change, but at the same time, I have to have in the back of my mind the possibility that some parts of the prevailing consensus may not be true.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with each year that passes, it strikes me that that possibility diminishes, but it's still there, right? I mean, it's still possible that the world may not this particular story may not unfold the way we think it will unfold now. So we need, as journalists, to fairly and appropriately represent that possibility.
Mm-hmm. It almost strikes me, actually, that lots of journalists, particularly maybe in audiovisual media, they are maybe more the opposite of defaulting to truth. Right? They almost assume that the people that they speak to is lying, like a politician or a CEO or whomever.
Yeah, but I mean, that kind of journalism is so nihilistic that I don't think it ever has any real traction. I think it's possible to make a momentary splash with that kind of thinking, but after a while, people start to roll their eyes at that.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, I sometimes think it's almost expected of journalists to be critical all the time, even though they could sometimes simply be listening to whatever the person they're talking to is saying and digest it first, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't think... I believe very strongly in the ultimate beauty of default to truth. I think it's a lovely part about human beings.
Right. So in your talk yesterday, you mentioned how many people are overconfident in their ability to assess other people.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't exclude yourself from the theory, as I think you have a system for doing job interviews, because I think the research showed that maybe job interviews are not the best way of hiring people.
Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit about that phenomenon and also how you tried to circumvent it in your own hiring procedures, because you do hire people?
Yeah, well, I mean, I began years ago by making people remove the names of the educational institutions they attend from their resume. That was my first step, because in America, where you went to college is this enormously significant, socially significant fact, and the schools are very hierarchical. And I became convinced that I was inappropriately enthusiastic towards people who went to elite schools and inappropriately dismissive of those who did not. And in my experience, there was very little correlation between where you went to school and how well you performed the job. So I first thing I started to do was said, you must remove all those names from your resume. I don't want to know where you went to school. And then I went further, and I don't really want to know where you grew up, because I also worry a little bit about that being a predictor. That was the first kind of go round. And then after writing this book, I began to think, well, why am I meeting them? What is the value of the face-to-face encounter? And nothing that comes from the face-to-face encounter is of relevance to their ability to do the job. So I'm learning from a face-to-face encounter whether they're attractive, whether they're tall or short, how well they dress, whether they have tattoos, what's the color of their skin. None of those things have anything whatsoever to do with their ability to do the job of my assistant. So why am I gathering that information? In the book, I get into this idea that we greatly overvalue the significance of the evidence we gather in a brief face-to-face encounter, and that the stranger's true nature is impossible to kind of accurately retrieve in those kinds of settings. So why do them? So my current assistant I hired on the phone. I talked to her on the phone, and Camille's great. I don't know what I mean. I suspect I know she went to a fancy school.
Yeah.
I don't know which one, although I could guess because I know she went to school in New York. But at the time I hired her, I had no clue where she went to school. I think it's very important. When I look at Pushkin, this company, I just started a company in the last year with a friend of mine. We now have 17 employees. With very few exceptions, I have no idea where any of our employees went to school.
you didn't. So you hired. You were personally involved in hiring.
I was,
most of them. Or?
No, I was not personally involved in hiring most of them. But they were all hired on their track record in the workplace, not their educational qualifications. And there's one woman who is responsible for most of the hiring, and she turns out to be very good at this. And I don't even think she even asks for a resume, for example.
Right.
She just knows people's work. She's hiring audio people. She knows their work. So she, so it's just this weird thing about the hiring process just strikes me as being fundamentally irrational in many ways.
Right. But these people, so that's like a very transparent market, so to speak. Because these people worked in audio, so you can just listen back to whatever.
Yes, it is. And I realize that's...
It's relatively easy.
That's relatively easy. Yeah. But you know, there's a further complication when it comes to promoting people, because you're very often promoting people to jobs that have nothing to do with the job they had before. But you're using the job they had, the performance of the job they had before, as a proxy for their ability to do the new job, which is makes no sense, right?
The old Peter principle.
Yeah, which I'm kind of fascinated by the Peter principle.
It is true.
It's profoundly true. I mean, we pick principals from the pool of teachers. There's nothing, very little about being an effective teacher that predicts how well you'll do as a principal.
We pick coaches from players, right?
Yeah.
Managers from players. Is that an American sport, so I guess, more
or less
the same?
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
I mean, with some exceptions, but overwhelmingly, we even pick sports announcers from the pool of players, which...
As a marketing value, I guess, right? People want to see stars.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really say something about their ability to do their new jobs. No.
No. On the contrary, you know, in my experience, my most effective interviews are often in areas where I know nothing about the subject, because it forces me to ask better questions. Whereas when I know something, very often the questions aren't terribly useful, because I'm many, many, many steps ahead of my audience. So, you know, a sports announcer, maybe it's better if the sports announcer knows slightly less than the players on the field. I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Yeah. Mm. By the way, this culture of, so you have the default to truth, and I maybe twisted it to the default to lies, maybe, or default to this deception. There was this episode in the Revision History about the research, I hope I pronounced her name correctly, Margit Hamosh.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So there was this time when the science desk of the Post was maybe also in thrall of this.
Everyone. It was a period where every science writer in America
was
consumed with this notion that fraud was rampant in American science. And it wasn't just journalists, by the way. It was being pushed by Congress and by scientists themselves. Everybody was kind of just a flutter with this particular idea.
So maybe final thing, what does your life look now? So you're now in book promotion mode, I suppose, for weeks, months?
I have one more, I go back to London, and I have 1 week in the UK and Ireland, and then I'm finished. Promotion will be over, and I'll now be working on season 5 of Revisionist History.
All right, greatly looking forward. And thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Malcolm Gladwell, wat een man. Ik hoop dat je het een leuk gesprek vond. Wil je meer van dit soort verhalen lezen of horen? Ga dan naar decorrespondent.nl/wordlid.